2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 233, The Surviving Smiths, Joseph and Lucy's Family After the Martyrdom. A panel discussion featuring William D. Russell, Lavina Fielding Anderson, William Shepherd, and Melvin Smith.
At 8 o'clock on the cloudless morning of 29th June 1844, all Nauvoo was greeting the neighbors of Joseph and Helen Smith. An estimated 10,000 waited outside the mansion house for the viewing to begin. Inside, members of the Smith family were escorted into the dining room for a few moments of private grief. Mary Fielding Smith and Emma Hale Smith, both of whom were pregnant, screamed, reeled back, and had to be supported from the room. 11-year-old Joseph III dropped upon his knees beside his father's corpse, laid his cheek against his father's, and kissed him, exclaiming over and over, "Oh, my father, my father." The martyr's widowed mother, 68-year-old Lucy Mack Smith, had spent a night, a day, and another night accepting the stunning news of the deaths and preparing herself for this moment. A year later, dictating her memoir, she said, "I braced every nerve, roused every energy of my soul, and called upon God to strengthen me. But when I entered the room and saw my murdered sons extended both at once before my eyes, and heard the sobs and groans of my family, it was too much. I sank back, crying to the Lord in the agony of my soul." Eunice Billings, who wrote her recollections of this scene 66 years later, reported, "I shall never forget the impression made upon me when the prophet's mother saw the bodies of her dead sons." In addition to Eunice Billings, the men who had escorted and prepared the bodies were doubtless present, as were other close friends. The late Mary Kimball, Heber C. Kimball's wife, for instance, reported that the anguished tears of the family were enough to wring the heart of an adamant. Also present but unremarked were the three loyal sisters of Joseph and Hiram. We would not even know that they were there, except that Lucy includes them in her description of the cries of father, husband, brothers that burst from the lips of their wives, children, brother, and sisters. From adolescence on, Lucy's daughters faithfully followed their prophet brother, supporting the family mission of restoration, arguably subordinating even their own marriages and the needs of their children to that cause, and always remaining overshadowed by their dazzling brother. Once more, they were faithfully present, their grief as great, their loss as rending, but not one account of the funeral mentions them by name, nor were their husbands given any role in the services. Even at a time and in a place, not just in Mormondom, where women had virtually no public role, I still see Lucy's three daughters, Sophronia, Catherine, and young Lucy, as among the most obscure women in the church. Mother Lucy does not mention their births, baptisms, marriages, or children, except when their personal stories overlap pressingly with the main narrative of the Restoration. None of the three daughters left an autobiography or reminiscence. It is not clear how well educated they were, though apparently all were literate. They appear only in glimpses or as part of the crowd scenes of the pageant of Mormon history, even though they were devoted, uncomplaining, and self-sacrificing members of their brother's church. Their husbands, also Mormons, likewise never had significant church positions. Like Lucy, her daughters did not go west. Two became members of the reorganization presided over by Joseph III. All were witnesses to the Restoration, but no one ever solicited or recorded that witness, except from Catherine, whose long life let her live into a third generation. The oldest of these sisters was Sophronia, 31 at the time of the martyrdom. She was the fourth child and first surviving daughter of Joseph and Lucy's Smith's 11 children, having been preceded by an unnamed stillborn son, Alvin and Hiram. Lucy omits mention of her birth, but she was about 3 years younger than Hiram and 2.5 years older than Joseph. Thus, she was closest in age to the two martyr brothers. Sophronia first appears on the family stage when she was about 11, during the typhus epidemic of 1813-14, when the Smiths were living in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Lucy tells the moving story of the three-month siege during which the physician withdrew his services, finding her beyond his help. Lucy and Joseph Sr. threw themselves on their knees beside the bed and pled with the Lord for Sophronia's life. Then Lucy picked her up, wrapped her in a quilt, and paced the floor with her, continuing to pray. Since Lucy was small, no more than 5 feet tall, by some accounts, this 11-year-old daughter must have been nothing more than skin and bones for Lucy to be able to walk with her. The mother's faith was rewarded when Sophronia gave a sob, then started to breathe again. Sophronia was 24 in September 1827 when Joseph returned from his midnight excursion to the hill Cumora, bringing the plates. What had Sophronia's participation been in the family circle, as he had told them Nephite stories for the previous 3 years? Was she allowed to view the plates bundled in their wrappings, as other family members were, or allowed to touch the Urim and Thummim, as Lucy was? We have no information. We know that she had joined the Presbyterian Church probably in the winter of 1824-25 or the spring of 1825 with her mother, Hiram, and Samuel, soon after Alvin's death. Sophronia was simultaneously being courted by Calvin W. Stoddard, whom she married in December 1827 at Palmyra. Calvin, about a year and a half her senior, is by some reputed to be the carpenter on the Smiths' new home and hence the man who defrauded the family by misrepresentations to the land agent. It seems far-fetched that Sophronia would have welcomed the advances of a man who had cheated her family, nor does it seem likely that any prospective bridegroom would have treated his future in-laws so cavalierly. In fact, there were other Stoddard families in the Palmyra neighborhood. Both Calvin and Sophronia were probably baptized Mormon in April or June of 1830. At this point, their first child, a daughter named Eunice, had been born in March and died, so perhaps the organization of the church and their own baptisms were tempered by this first great sorrow. Calvin was ordained an elder in 1831 and helped construct the Kirtland Temple. The next year, their second and last child, Maria, was born. Calvin's patriarchal blessing by Joseph Sr. in December 1834 mentions that he had been excommunicated, rebaptized, and was at that time excommunicated, but there are no details of how he had offended against Mormon orthodoxy. Sophronia received her patriarchal blessing the day before. Joseph Jr. linked Calvin with William Smith on January 1836 as being attacked by the devil and causing a division in the family. The Kirtland Elders' Quorum minutes record that Calvin made a confession, without specifying of what, in March 1836. 7 months later, the minutes state that he was allowed to retain his license. This may have been a posthumous action since Calvin's death date is recorded as 5 weeks earlier. After 17 months of widowhood, Sophronia married William McCleary, a wagon maker in Kirtland, originally from Vermont. He was 45 years old, 10 years Sophronia senior, which makes it probable that he was a widower. He either was or became a Mormon, since Father Joseph gave him a patriarchal blessing in October 1837. 4 months later, he was ordained an elder, and in May 1838, went with the Smiths to Missouri. No details of the family's brief stay in Missouri have survived, but the daughters apparently lived with or near Lucy and Joseph Sr., since Lucy says her daughters helped her run the tavern in which Joseph Jr. had installed them and also helped nurse family members through serious illnesses. After the fall of Far West and the arrests of Joseph and Hiram in October 1838, William and Sophronia crossed the state with the rest of the family to Illinois in February 1839. Where they lived and what they did becomes obscure. Sophronia and presumably William and Maria were present for Joseph Sr.'s death in 1840. William was at least once faced with ecclesiastical charges of unbelief and never served a mission, which in itself can be interpreted as a statement of unbelief. Yet church records show that William and Sophronia were endowed on December 23, 1845, sealed almost exactly a month later, and that their 13-year-old Maria was endowed the same day. William built wagons for the Nauvoo Exodus, but died before the evacuation of Nauvoo. In 1850, Sophronia and Maria were living with Sophronia's sister Lucy. When Maria married, Sophronia began living with her. She died in 1876 at age 73, and a relative wrote, "She was ever
ready to bear her testimony to the truth of the work, and she fell asleep in Christ without a struggle, with full hope of being raised in the first resurrection. But she was a Presbyterian at that point, not a Mormon. Joseph Sr.'s dying blessing on Sophronia acknowledged her sorrows. "Thy troubles shall be lessened, for thou hast been faithful in helping thy father and thy mother in the work of the Lord. The blessings of heaven shall rest down upon thee. Thy last days shall be thy best. Although thou shalt see trouble, sorrow, and mourning, thou shalt be comforted, and thou shalt live as long as thou desirest life." What did this blessing mean to Sophronia as she aged? She did indeed live long, but were her last days her best? Maria had only one child, a daughter, who died in giving birth to her first child, who also died. Thus, Sophronia has no living descendants. Sophronia was 10 when Catherine was born, and 18 when young Lucy was born. It seems likely that she would have identified more with her mother as household manager, nurse, and cook than as companion to either of her sisters, especially since she had only one child, which automatically freed her for more tasks within the extended family. Catherine was the 9th child, 7 years younger than Joseph, 5 years younger than Samuel, and 2 years younger than William. Mother Lucy mentions neither her birth, her baptism, nor her marriage. When Lucy took her children from New York to Kirtland in March 1831, she does not mention any of the children except William. And this important Smith family move coincided closely with Catherine's marriage at age 18 to 22-year-old Wilkins Jenkins Salisbury. Did the young couple follow later, or were they unrecorded participants? Wilkins was born in Lebanon, New York, so the families were probably old acquaintances. His professions are given as both lawyer and blacksmith, so the marriage seemed to promise economic ease for the young people. If this is true, then sacrificing such comforts was part of the price Catherine paid for following her brother. Wilkins and Catherine had 8 children, 5 sons and 3 daughters, born over the next 18 years. Their birthplaces are a litany of Mormon settlement sites: New York, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. After their escape from Missouri with the rest of the Smith family, however, Wilkins and Catherine kept a little apart. They did not settle in Nauvoo, but a few miles away in Fountain Green, where Wilkins apparently sustained the family as a blacksmith. When Joseph Sr. died, Wilkins was so ill with malaria that Catherine had to bring him with her upon a bed sick when she finally came on the second day after her father's interment. According to Lucy, Catherine remained with me some time and comforted me what she could. Even though Catherine had not been present, Joseph Sr. had dictated a dying blessing for her. "The Lord has looked down upon her and seen her patience and heard her cries, and she shall be comforted when the days of her sorrow are ended. She shall live to raise up her family, and she shall rise over her enemies, and she shall have houses, horses, and land, and things round her to make her heart glad, and she shall receive eternal life." Again, was this blessing fulfilled? There is considerable evidence that Catherine's life was marked by acute poverty. Almost 3 years after the family reached Illinois, when we could expect them to have achieved some financial stability, Willard Richards records Joseph's visit to Catherine in Plymouth. "My heart was pained to see a lovely wife and sister of Joseph almost barefoot, and 4 lovely children entirely so in the middle of winter. Ah, thought I, what has not Joseph and his father's family suffered to bring forth the work of the Lord?" When Wilkins died in 1853, Catherine was so poor that she wrote to Wilkins' sister, whom she had not seen for at least 20 years, begging for a contribution so she could put up a headstone. Later, Brigham Young on at least 2 occasions sent her money, $400, then an additional $200. The last gift was accompanied by a letter that spoke of Brigham's deeply cherished memory of Joseph Smith. "For his sake, his relatives and members of his family, notwithstanding differences of opinion, are kindly regarded and would be received with open arms were they willing to adhere to the principles taught by the prophet." Brigham may have been making an oblique reference to polygamy, but if so, Catherine failed to take the hint. In April 1893, at an RLDS conference, she testified, "I was at Joseph's house in Nauvoo a great many times and conversed with him about many subjects, but I never heard him at any time mention such a thing as the plural wife system or order, and I heard nothing of such a doctrine existing until a year after his death." There is also some evidence that Salisbury was not a model of faithfulness, even though he was called on a mission, went on Zion's camp, received the patriarchal blessing, and was ordained as 70. Accused with Almon Babbitt of violating the word of wisdom in 1833, Salisbury was charged by Oliver Cowdery in 1836 with bringing unnecessary persecution upon Joseph Jr. by his behavior, leaving his family without food, provisions, or information about where he was going or when he would return, using strong drink and being intimate with other women. Salisbury admitted drinking and tale-bearing, but denied the other charges. He was excommunicated until there was a thorough reformation. If he was rebaptized, I have not found the date. However, he followed the rest of the Smiths and the church until his death. Until Joseph Jr.'s death, not Salisbury's death. When Joseph III became president of the RLDS Church, Catherine was received into it on the basis of her 1830 baptism. Her oldest son, Solomon Jenkins Salisbury, was converted by a vision during illness telling him to send for Joseph III. He was baptized and participated faithfully in Pilot Grove Second Branch, Illinois, until his death at 92. Certainly a source of suffering and sorrow for Catherine was the murder of her second son, Alvin, baptized RLDS at age 39. According to Joseph III, Catherine had a prophetic dream of Alvin's death and counseled him often to guard his temper. He was stabbed by a man with whom he had a long-standing quarrel. Alvin was a very large man and of immense strength, but was unarmed. Contrary to what we might think, that this was yet another example of anti-Mormon sentiment, Susan Sessions Rue's impressive reconstruction of social life in Fountain Green fills out the details, even though she does not identify Alvin as Joseph Smith's nephew. The two men, Alvin and Thomas Duff, met on the steps of the Fountain Green Presbyterian Church at a Republican rally for Garfield. Salisbury, only recently a Republican, responded to a question with an insult, "Show me a Democrat and I will show you a drunkard," or "Show me a drunkard and I will show you a Democrat." Duff intruded himself into the argument, "My father is a Democrat and he is no drunkard and you know it." Salisbury, a tall, bony, and muscular man, told Duff to mind his own business, and the quarrel escalated. Duff dodged Alvin's fist and stabbed him in the chest and upper arm. Salisbury stepped back, and Duff plunged the blade of the knife into his forehead. Alvin died 24 hours later without gaining consciousness. A posse captured Duff, who was found guilty and sent to the penitentiary. So many wished to attend Alvin's funeral that even though he was a Methodist, services were held at the larger Presbyterian church where he had been killed. Thus ended a feud beginning 7 years earlier when the two men had shot at each other. Both Alvin and an unnamed sister were grazed by the bullets, but Duff was acquitted. Catherine had reason to warn Alvin of danger from his anger. Catherine recorded her memories of Joseph bringing home the plates in 1886, testified in 1892 in the Temple Lot suit, and also the next year bore her testimony in the RLDS World Conference. She died in 1900 at Fountain Green. The next year, grandson Herbert S. Salisbury became president of Graceland College and, 18 years later, assistant RLDS church historian. The youngest daughter, Lucy, was born in 1821 at Palmyra when Joseph was 16. As usual, she figures only briefly in the family narrative. Once when Mother Lucy recounts Lucy's baby horror at Alvin's death when she was 2, and again during the sufferings in Missouri when the mud was so deep that it sucked her boots off, forcing Joseph Sr. to probe for them with his cane. At age 18, she married Arthur Milliken, a convert 4 years her senior from Saco, Maine. According to a family story, he was the drummer boy at the Battle of Crooked River and was shot through both legs above the knee. He recuperated in the Smith Family Tavern at Far West, and no doubt young Lucy, who helped with the nursing, formed her attachment to him then. As was common with the youngest child, there seems to have been a particular affinity between Lucy and her parents, but this partiality, which did not stop short of favoritism, extended to Arthur as well. When Joseph Sr. lay dying, he asked Arthur to promise to be kind to daughter Lucy, a promise he did not exact from his other sons-in-law, then bestowed a blessing. "You shall be great in the eyes of the Lord, and if you will be faithful, you shall have all the desires of your heart in righteousness." He asked Arthur to fetch Catherine, who was nursing her sick husband, for I know that because of the faithfulness of your heart, you will not come back without her. To daughter Lucy, Joseph Sr. spoke endearingly, Lucy, thou art my youngest child, my darling, and the Lord gave thee unto us to be a comfort and a blessing in our old age. Therefore thou must take good care of thy mother. Thou art innocent, and thy heart is right before the Lord. Thou hast seen nothing but persecution, sickness, and trouble, except when the Lord hath cheered our hearts. If thou wilt continue faithful, thou shalt be blessed with a house and land. Thou shalt have food and raiment, and no more be driven, and thou shalt receive your reward in heaven. In Nauvoo, Arthur ran a harness business on the corner of Parley and Durfee Streets. After the martyrdom, they moved to Colchester, Illinois, near Catherine, Sophronia, and temporarily William. Arthur worked in a railroad office and in the mining business. The entire family eventually affiliated with the RLDS Church. Joseph III characterized Arthur as my favorite uncle, the soul of honor, while Lucy was one of the most pleasant-mannered women I have known. They had 9 children. Arthur died in 1882, followed by Lucy 8 months later. Who knows what strength these devoted sisters, devoted to each other and to the gospel restored to their brother, might have added to the church in Utah or to the Restoration if Joseph III had given them a more central place. They were always obscure, but perhaps the lack of turmoil in their later lives was reward enough. Without the diaries, interviews, and letters that draw more complete portraits of the Smith men, it is not possible to trace an alternate trajectory for the Smith women, but I think it is fair to draw 4 conclusions. First, they unquestionably identified themselves as Smiths. To an 1845 conference, Mother Lucy gives a glimpse of her daughters. I have 3 daughters at home. They have never had anything but have worked for the church. All 3 of these women were married, yet the widowed Lucy describes them as if they were part of her household. Emotionally, that is certainly true. But equally importantly, they identified themselves as Mormons. At age 65, Catherine testified, many times when I have read the Book of Mormon's sacred pages, I have wept like a child while the Spirit has borne witness with my spirit to its truth. What additional details could the other sisters have added? Second, they may have been unfortunate in their choice of husbands. The evidence is scanty, but it hints that they did not fit comfortably into Mormonism's evolving structure. The contrast becomes clear if we compare the sons-in-law to Joseph's cousin, George A. Smith, or with his brothers. The brothers-in-law did not serve multiple missions, take advantage of every opportunity to associate with Joseph Smith, or progress steadily through a series of ever more responsible priesthood callings. Even Arthur, who cared for Joseph's riding gear in Nauvoo, was not rewarded with the usual priesthood offices. Did they drink too much, not work hard enough? Did Joseph exclude them from his inner circle because he felt their doubts, or did being excluded cause their doubts? Another possible interpretation is that they resented the unremitting toil, sacrifice, and physical danger that they, their wives, and children were exposed to as a result of their association with their charismatic brother-in-law. Is it possible that they saw they could either be responsible fathers or committed Mormons, but not both at the same time? Were they trying to put their own families first by putting the Smith family second? In the absence of further information, these speculations must remain just that. Third, the sisters' loyalty to Joseph did not transfer to Brigham Young and the 12. Sophronia was the only daughter to accept temple ordinances. Although all 3 must have understood the temple's importance to Joseph, did something in them draw back from the new theological web that almost certainly included polygamy? Although relationships with the 12 seems to have been cordial enough until William Smith forced an open breach, the saints went west, but the Smith sisters did not. Fourth, even the second Smith church had no comfortable place for them. In 1860, when Joseph III accepted leadership of the reorganization, none of his aunts was present. Sophronia died in the Presbyterian faith she had adopted as a young woman. Still, when RLDS missionaries traveled through Illinois in the 1870s, they gathered Catherine and Lucy and most of their children into the reorganization. To sum up the lives of Lucy's daughters, in a society and in two churches that limited the expression of women's voices, Lucy's daughters occupied the same marginal position that she did herself. And even in the family memoir that Lucy created, her daughters are almost invisible, almost inaudible, voices of early Mormonism that are forever lost. Thank you.
After the exodus from Far West, William Smith settled at Plymouth, Illinois, and kept a tavern. He was suspended from fellowship in 1839 for his vindictive conduct towards his brother Joseph in the late Missouri period, but was reinstated 3 weeks later through the intercession of Joseph and Hiram. He failed to accompany the other apostles to England as he was directed, but did take a short mission to the eastern states in 1841 to collect money for the temple, but Andrew Jensen charged he kept some of the money for his own use. He founded a newspaper, The Wasp, in Nauvoo in 1842 and carried on a controversy with Thomas Sharp, the editor of the Warsaw Signal, which helped the reputation of the Mormons. He was a member of the Nauvoo City Council, and as a member of the Illinois Legislature in 1843, played a key role in preventing the repeal of the Nauvoo Charter. A mission to the eastern states followed in 1843, in which the most significant event was in giving the presiding elder of the New Egypt, New Jersey branch excommunicated. In 1844, he accompanied Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, and Lyman White to the eastern states. He remained in the east with the other apostles when the other apostles hurried back to Nauvoo because of the serious illness of his wife Caroline and the fear his life would be in danger from Gentiles in Nauvoo. During this period, he joined with George J. Adams to take money donated for the temple for their own use, and also, along with Adams and Samuel Bannon, taught that they could legally have sex with female members. His instability was demonstrated when he denied stealing money and having sexual liaisons, and then having four presiding elders excommunicated who correctly charged him with these crimes. The seeds for a future confrontation began on 8 August 1844 at a special meeting when Brigham Young acknowledged, quote, "the right of the patriarchal blessings belongs to Joseph's family," unquote. This was followed by a 15 August announcement in the Times and Seasons by Young as president of the 12 apostles, stating, quote, "You are now without a president with a prophet present with you in the flesh to guide you, but you are not without apostles who hold the keys of power to seal on earth that which shall be sealed in heaven and to preside over the affairs of your church. Let no man presume for a moment that his, Joseph's, place will be fulfilled by another." These pronouncements surely stimulated William to feel that the 12 apostles equally shared authority, and that if he was to obtain the office of patriarch, which office held superior authority to the apostles when Hiram was alive, this would result in his holding the highest authority in the church. On 28 September 1844, Young told William by a letter to come to Nauvoo and be ordained patriarch. Young was unaware that William had already been given patriarchal blessings in the East. Young, at the 6 October 1844 conference, said, quote, "Did Joseph ordain any man to take his place? He did. Who was it? It was Hiram," unquote. The transformation in the authority of the office of patriarch took another turn when either John Taylor or William W. Phelps announced in the 1 December 1844 Times and Seasons that William would soon return to Nauvoo and be ordained patriarch. However, it was clear the authority had been downgraded as William would, quote, "occupy the place that his brother Hiram did when living, and he will stand in the same relation to the 12 as his brother Hiram did to the first presidency after he was ordained patriarch," unquote. William Woodcliffe wrote Young on 3 December 1844 and complained about William stealing money and intended for the temple, and his actions with female members and begged, quote, if you want to save the Eastern Church, to delegate someone of the 12 from Nauvoo that will act with you and come and take charge, someone besides Williams or Adams. Keep an eye on Brother Williams and Adams, unquote. William and his dying wife Caroline arrived at Nauvoo on 4 May 1845 and moved into Emma Smith. He immediately started opposing the 12 apostles by siding with the Hodge brothers, who were notorious Mormon criminals. William and Stephen Hodge murdered two Mennonites in Iowa on 10 May, and when they returned to Nauvoo, William opposed the authorities and told them to flee Nauvoo, as opposed to Young's demand that they be arrested and prosecuted. After they were arrested, William told the Nauvoo police to set them free. A week after his arrival at Nauvoo, James M. Monroe recorded in his diary strained relations between Young and William over the treatment of how the enemies were treated. Caroline died on 22 June, leaving William with two young daughters. On 23 June, 19 days after William's arrival at Nauvoo, Heber C. Campbell recorded, quote, went to see Bishop Whitney. Sister Whitney told me that William Smith came there yesterday, expressed enmity against Brother Young and myself, that we had taken rights from him, unquote. The same day, William Clayton reported that William was coming out in opposition to the 12 in favor of George J. Adams and observed, quote, there is more danger from William than from any other source, unquote. In spite of these warnings, the following day, William was ordained patriarch by Young. 5 days later, the apostles were meeting together to pray, quote, that the Lord would overrule the movements of William Smith, unquote. And Monroe recorded that William was wonderfully angry at the editors of the Nauvoo Neighbor because they would not let him to respond to published comments by Parley P. Pratt. William said, quote, the Neighbor is a mean little stinking paper just fit for jack shit. And that Brigham Young was made a president by courtesy. A letter written by William in the early June period appeared in the 15 May Times and Seasons, which announced he was living at the William Marks house, was ready to bestow patriarchal blessings. He emphasized his many sacrifices he had made in the church, and that he had set the Eastern churches in order, quote, after having labored diligently in teaching them the true principles of virtue, unquote. William emphasized his heritage as the last of the Smiths and pushed the belief that the 12 apostles equally shared church leadership. William W. Phelps responded in the same issue by saying, quote, the office of patriarch over the whole church is to be a father to the church and to confer blessings on its enemies. I'm sure William loved that statement, that to be over the whole church. Phelps' response must have infuriated Brigham and the other apostles, because John Taylor responded in the next issue of the Times and Season. So far as the editorial is concerned, it was written rather hastily by our junior editor, W.W. Phelps, and did not come under our notice until after it was published. There are some expressions contained in it which might have been worded better and have rendered it less subject to criticism, but he assured us that no such intention was intended to be conveyed as that which is conceived by some. And concerning Brother William Smith, we are better acquainted with him and his views than to believe that he intended to convey any such idea as the one which some persons would put upon or gather from his sayings. We have been asked, does the office of patriarch over the whole church place Brother William Smith at the head of the whole church as president? No. Brother William is not patriarch over the whole church, but patriarch to the church, and as such he was ordained. The expression over the whole church is a mistake made by W.W. Phelps. He is patriarch to the church. And who has charge of the whole priesthood here? The presidency of the church, and not the patriarch. On 22 June, Young performed the marriage between William and 16-year-old Mary Jane Rawlins. This inspired Thomas Sharp to respond to the marriage in the Warsaw Signal. Quote, Patriarch Bill Smith was again married on last Sunday week, having been a widower about 18 days. His bride is about 16 and he is 35. Bill will do very well for a father to the church, but his wife won't do for a mother. Mary Jane, I was glad to see, deserted William within 2 months. And Helen Mar Whitney observed, quote, He, William, married a very pretty young girl, and though the character she bore was not of the best, she was good enough for him. In 1847, Hiram Stratton gave sworn testimony that Mary Jane was known as a common prostitute in Nauvoo. Mm-hmm. On 22 June, Young married 14-year-old Miss Rice to William. William took at least 6 polygamous wives at Nauvoo and deserted most of them when he fled Nauvoo. The testimony of Mary Ann West at the Temple Lot trial in 1893 is both indicative of his character and amusing. After saying that William deserted her when he left Nauvoo, she testified, quote, Brigham Young sealed me to Smith for eternity. I do not think there will be any trouble in getting me out of being sealed to Smith for eternity. I do not think Smith will ever come where I am to claim me. I do not think there will let him in where I will be. At the sentencing of his brothers, William and Stephen Hodge, to be hung on 22 June, the older brother, Irving Hodge, loudly proclaimed at Burlington, Iowa, that if Young did not help get his brothers released from jail, he would tell the Gentiles all he knew about the Mormon stealing. The following day, Irving spent time with William Smith in the afternoon, went to Brigham Young's house, threatened his life if he wouldn't help him get his brothers out of jail. 10:30 the same evening, he comes to Brigham Young's house, guarded by two of his faithful policemen. He is brutally, savagely murdered, a rod or so from Brigham Young's door. Right after he's dead, William Smith shows back up. The following day, William beat up policeman Elbridge Tufts for not releasing another Hodge brother. This is Amos Hodge. Amos was the president, president of the 13th Quorum of 70s. But at that time, he was under indictment for murder, for robbery in Iowa. Amos was being placed under arrest for theft. William beats up the policeman. Then he goes and bails out Amos. Amos disappears from history. William testifies later that he is murdered by the Nauvoo police. On the 25th, he wrote Young and pleaded with him to keep the police from killing him. He was especially scared of Elbridge Tufts. Young told him to attend a meeting that evening. Accordingly, William left his daughters with his mother, offered his appearance, and told his family he feared he might be assassinated. And his fear was real. He was expecting the meeting at the Masonic Hall to be with the hierarchy, but was terrified to find the meeting was also attended by 50 to 60 heavily armed police. In part, Young told William and the audience that William had been spreading the story that he, Young, instigated Irving Hodges' murder, that William had no right to side with the Hodges, and he defended the Nauvoo police against William. William had no choice but to say his actions had been misunderstood and that he would support the police. He later said the intimidating atmosphere of the meeting convinced him to flee Nauvoo. Shortly after this meeting, the Smiths arose to find on the porch had been desecrated with outhouse waste, William's house. On 27 June, Mother Lucy Smith had a vision about the danger William was in and his right to stand at the head of the church. It is difficult to know the actual content of the vision because William Clayton said that William Smith corrected and altered it. Tensions increased when on 29 June, Brigham said from the stand, quote, "I don't know nor care who killed Irving Hodge, for if he lived, he would add sin to sin. There are other men in my way that I pray God may run up against the same snags that Irving Hodge did," unquote. The following day, William wrote Young, quote, "My proposition is my share of the kingdom. If you will publish in the Neighbor and Times and Seasons the true state of the case in regard to my office as patriarch over the whole church, this will give me the right to visit all branches of the church, no man being my head. I will reconcile all difficulties, and Elder Young can stand as the president of the church," unquote. The 2 July Warsaw Signal contained an article which included, quote, "The division between Bill Smith and the 12 appears to be growing wider every day. A gentleman who is with Nauvoo says that the 12 charge William Smith with the murder of Irving Hodge, and William Smith is charging the 12 as murdering poor Irving. William and Stephen Hodge were hanged on 15 July, and their bodies were buried in Nauvoo Cemetery. In an open meeting with about 4 or 5 apostles there, they actually had an argument on the stand. Brigham Young and Orson Pratt want the bodies removed. William stands up stupidly, I think, and he says, "No, they're good men. They should remain in the cemetery." Brigham won, and they removed and reburied the bodies. The 23 July Warsaw Signal expected about why Amos Hodge had not been seen in public after the death of his brother Irving, and then said, quote, "It was rumored that Bill Smith prophesied that Irving Hodge would not live another day on the night before he was murdered." Following the 9 July banquet served to the extended Smith family by the hierarchy, relatively good feeling seemed to prevail until the end of the first week of August. William asked Young in a 9 August letter for permission to function independently as patriarch. Young, in a 10 August letter, would not give that permission, and William later wrote that he never could understand being ordained by apostles, who he said, "I held superior authority to," and he quoted it this way: "This was as the Paddy said, an Irishman lift a peg or two lower, exalted downward instead of upward." In the same letter, Young refused to reimburse William $74 in expenses. This seems justified, as Kimball had to pay the rent on the nice home where William lived after he slipped out of town. William committed a monumental blunder when he announced from the stand in his sermon titled "The First Chapter of the Gospel by St. William" that Young, Kimball, and others were, quote, "practicing polygamy in secret," but that he was not afraid to do it openly. John Taylor, the only other apostle at the meeting, attempted to add damage control, but the damage had been done. There are several journal accounts which show the angry responses of men who were secretly practicing polygamy. The ever-vigilant Thomas Sharp gleefully printed, quote, "Bill from the stand avowed that the spiritual wife system was taught and practiced, and he practiced it, and he is not in favor of making any secret of the matter. He said that it was common thing amongst the leaders, and that he, for one, was not ashamed of it. His bold declaration created quite a sensation among the saints, and Bill is in hot water in consequence of it." unquote. William, in a letter to her brother William on 20 August, said that he would start for the East and would give patriarchal blessings in the fall. He said, quote, "I find I cannot live here, though continually in the exercise of my office, the people are so poor," unquote. In other words, he could make better money giving blessings in the East. The good news was dashed after Parley P. Pratt and convinced Young that allowing William to operate independently would lead to disastrous consequences. In mid-September, William told a man his Uncle John Smith had sent to him posing as a member of the mob that he was going east, quote, "and by God, I'll let the people know who their ruler is," unquote. The fact William left furniture and personal possessions when he slipped out of Nauvoo indicates he departed in secret. His possessions were later at auction to pay his creditors. He wrote Young on 25 September that a mob was searching for him near Augusta, Iowa, and he could not make it back to Nauvoo. However, William was probably lying, as a James Brown wrote George A. Smith the following day, that William was safely quartered in George J. Adams' home in Augusta. He went to Galena, Illinois, where his pamphlet, A Proclamation and Faithful Warning, was printed. He sent a copy of this scathing work to Thomas Sharp, his mortal enemy, who printed it on the total front page of the 29 October Warsaw Signal. William said, William repeated a standard charge, many of the standard charges he had saved the church from Sidney Rigdon, his poor mother, is suffering because of the way they're treating him, and that young Joseph Smith is the true prophet. The most sensational charge he made is that Brigham Young and Parley P. Pratt were the first to preach and to practice the spiritual life doctrine in the city of Boston and other places, and self-righteously added, quote, "My dissent from any such doctrine, of course, gave great annoyance," unquote. He also charged that Young Kimball and Willard Richards were supporting their wives and children at Nauvoo by using tithing money, and that he had heard his brother Joseph say that Young, quote, "was a man whose passions, if unrestrained, were calculated to make him the most licentious man in the world," unquote. The most sensational aspect may have been his dramatic account of the murder of Irving Hodge, which strongly indicated he was murdered by the Nauvoo police at the instigation of Brigham Young. He went to St. Louis, where he fractured the unity of the branch. Word was soon circulating that he was living with a teenage Catholic girl. A good place to wrap this up is a revealing letter from William Smith on 21 November to Emma Smith, in which he expressed surprise that she would not help me reform the church after he had challenged the usurpation of the 12 apostles and their practice of the spiritual life doctrine. He rather pathetically told her, quote, "Now, Emma, all hell is in a rage, and every lie that can be said on foot is on hand, and you believe them. I tell you, I have not spoken to a woman or had anything to do with them, and it is my purpose to avoid the very appearance of evil."
I'd like to say right off that I'm not here to tell anybody that we Smiths are not got plenty of crazy people among us. But Samuel's daughter, Mary Bailey Smith Norman, said that her Uncle Bill, she really loved him. He was really a good man. My paper, I want to give a brief overview of the life of Samuel Harrison Smith, and something of the family dynamics in which his life plays out, and then a brief review of some of the legacy that, as far as I'm concerned. The subject of Samuel Smith was born in Tunbridge, Vermont, March the 13th, 1808, and he is my great-grandfather. Since all history is seen through the warped warped lenses of both the historians and their readers' perceptions, I declare some of my own warps to start out here. I believe that history can tell us much about human beings in this world, but history's lens is neither a seer stone nor a Urim and Thummim through which God's hand is revealed. Therefore, I do not try to see divine will working out in Samuel's life. I am a trained historian with extensive exposure to the writings on the Smith family and Mormon history in general. However, my primary research is limited. My thanks to the likes of Levina and Bill, and Mike Quinn, Michael Marquardt, Dan Vogel, Dean Jesse, Marv Hill, Bill Moraine, Roger Anderson, Jesse Grossback, and too many others to name. I wouldn't be able to say anything about the paper. My personal biases will be evident in this presentation. I presume to know something about large family dynamics, both firsthand and from my studies. I also know something about depression and alcoholism in families, having lived up close and personal with both. So the Smith family story is my story, historically, genetically, ideologically, and consequentially. I also believe that what we see is controlled by what we believe is true and real. Einstein stated that the theory defines what can be seen. I find my own thinking ends up where I start with it. Several primary paradigms seem to define the Smith family reality. One, God ruled the universe and communicated with mankind through scriptures, dreams, visions, healings, and even magic. Both Mack and Smith progenitors witnessed to these beliefs, even suggesting that one of their own would be specially called for God's service. Both Joseph Sr. and Lucy experienced these phenomena. Each had a particular idea of how one related properly to the divine and obtained one's salvation. These beliefs, defined as pietism and rationalism, created a fertile environment for religious inquiry and innovation in the family. A second paradigm claimed that the universe was ruled by law. The prophet later stated, "There is a law upon which all blessings are predicated, and we obtain the blessing by obeying the law." With this premise, Joseph had the basis for building his theocracy. Thirdly, the force for evil was as real as the force for good. This paradigm explains why bad things happen to the Smiths, namely evil men and the devil. Rarely do the Smiths own their own ineptness. This family began in Tunbridge, Vermont, with the marriage of Joseph Sr. and Lucy Mack, January 25, 1796. The next 20 years would see the family move 8 times, suffer economic setbacks, business failures, and so forth, which culminated in their being warned out of Norwich, Vermont in March 1816. These troubles, together with the poor growing seasons of 1814, 15, and 16, precipitated their move to New York State. Those same years saw the birth of 10 children, the death of 2, life-threatening illnesses to Sophronia, Lucy, and to Joseph with his traumatic leg operations. I believe that Joseph Sr.'s alcoholism was a major factor in their chronic economic struggles, and even in his 7 visionary experiences. Lucy seems to have had bouts of depression. Just raising a large family can be depressing at times, and some say driving man to drink. While the Smiths had their share of bad luck, it may be fair to ask, were they also reaping what they were sowing? Joseph Sr. left for Palmyra in the fall of 1816. Lucy followed in January 1817 with her family of 8 children, ranging in ages from Alvin, 19, to Don Carlos, less than 1 year. Samuel was not yet 9. This heroic trip witnesses to Lucy's courage and strength. Something in the family dynamics created a sense of Smithness for the family members that would play out strongly for them over the next 3 decades. I give Mother Lucy much credit for that bonding. Once in New York State, the Smith family continued to struggle economically. They made at least 6 moves before going to Kirtland, Ohio in 1831. They would build a cabin on their own land and moved into it before July of 1823 and also began construction on their frame house before Alvin's death in 1823. However, it was not completed and moved into before October or November of 1825. Then, because the Smith family was in arrears on payments, they lost their home, which Lemuel Durfee finally got, and allowed them to live in it if Samuel had worked for him to pay for the rent, which he did for several months. Why such problems? Their enemies? The records indicate that the Smiths purchased their share of intoxicating beverages, but probably not unusually so. However, drinking for an alcoholic is far different than for the non-alcoholic, being an addiction to be served first at the expense of all other concerns. Additionally, dreams, visions of grandiosity, feelings of guilt, and concern for one's salvation are common to alcoholics. With the religious fervor of the 1820s, the Smiths' magic beliefs took on a particular dimension, centering more and more in the person of Joseph Jr. Their economic stresses and their magic became a two-edged sword. They desperately needed money, yet their money digging exacerbated their penury. But these beliefs playing out in their lives was pivotal for the family and for my great-grandfather. He would be captured by the story and the movement that came out of these conditions. I marvel at the family support given the prophet through all of this. Samuel, 12 at the time of Joseph's first vision in 1820, was exposed to Joseph's account of Moroni's visits and told what it all meant for the Smith family. While Samuel joined the Presbyterian Church in 1824, by 1827, he had little difficulty accepting that Joseph did have gold plates and was commanded to translate them. Joseph began the work of translation in Harmony, Pennsylvania. Samuel and his father visited him and Emma in February of 1829, where Samuel may have served briefly as scribe. He again visited Joseph in April, walking to Harmony with Oliver Cowdery, who became the primary scribe for translation. Samuel made the decision to satisfy himself as to the truth of the work. He was baptized somewhere near the 15th of May, 1829. Believing seemed easy for Samuel, and by age 21, he was a committed supporter of the new movement. He became one of the eight witnesses of the Book of Mormon and undertook his first mission to Livonia, New York, in October 1829. He was one of six charter members of the formal organization of the Church of Christ, April the 6th, 1830. He was ordained an elder at the First Church Conference, June the 9th, 1830, and left soon after for a mission in New York State. His work led to the conversion of Rhoda Young and John P. Green, Brigham Young and Heber Kimball, among others. He returned home to move Lucy and family from Fayette to Waterloo since his father was in jail. Ordained a high priest in 1831, Samuel filled four missions during the next 2.5 years, working with Orson Pratt in Ohio, Reynolds C. Calhoun, they went from Kirtland to Missouri to dedicate a temple site with others, William E. McClellan in eastern Ohio before he and Orson Hyde were called to go on to the eastern states on January the 25th, 1832. His companion described Samuel as slow of speech, but with great faith and integrity. Among their some 60 converts during the 11-month period were Sam Brannan, Mary Bailey, and the Angel family, like Truman and Marianne. An Angel family relative recently advised me that Gerald E. Jones had purchased a Book of Mormon which Samuel had left with a Melvin Wilbur in Providence, Rhode Island in 1832. Back in Kirtland, Samuel assisted in the laying the foundation stones for the Kirtland Temple. In February 1834, he became a member of the Kirtland High Council and would be sustained as council president on October the 2nd, 1837. He farmed nearby and worked as a laborer to support his family after he and Mary Bailey were married August the 13th, 1834. Their first daughter, Susanna, was born October the 27th, 1835. Mary nearly died in childbirth, but was attended by Dr. Frederick G. Williams and prayers. A second daughter, Mary, was born in Mentor, Ohio, March the 27th, 1837. In September 1835, Samuel was appointed to a literary firm assigned to sell church literature to church members. Samuel was charged that same year and fined $20 for neglect of military duties and had to sell his cow in order to pay for the fine. He was also caught up in the Williams conflict with Joseph over the Elliots' whipping of their 15-year-old daughter. While Samuel was quick to repent, William was not forgiving for several months. With the ordination of Joseph Sr., patriarch to the church, December 1834, Samuel received his father's blessing. His support of the family was acknowledged, and great blessings promised, including power over his adversaries, the elements, and the forces of evil. Samuel was to see visions and to stand upon Zion for the, quote, crowning of the tribes of Israel, and, quote, thou shalt see thy Redeemer come in the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly throng, end of quote. Lots of promises, none of which Samuel would see fulfilled in his lifetime. Joseph was also making major decisions that would impact Samuel and his family. With a revelation in August of 1833, the prophet introduced his concept of theocracy, wherein the word of God could override the law of the land. As spokesman for God, Joseph had the prerogative of dictating what God's will was in various matters, such as economics. With his law of consecration and McClellan's safety banking or anti-banking society. Both brought apostasy and hostility towards church leaders. A second theocratic principle defined how the church members should deal with their enemies in league with the devil, of course. Specifically, a revelation allowed retaliation after forgiving their enemies three times. Retaliations with God's blessing, even. Joseph was at this time also set apart as Secretary of War and Commander-in-Chief of the Armies of Israel. Zion's camp's trek from Kirtland to Missouri in 1834 concluded, fortunately, without actual combat. Joseph's claims of the saints being God's chosen people, commanded to set up the kingdom of God on earth, and to usher in the millennium in Missouri was a formula for conflict, hardship and death to the saints and to their neighbors, which played out in Missouri and in Illinois. Samuel and his family were caught up in all of this. Samuel participated in the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, March 27th to the 31st, 1836, seen then as a time of great outpouring of the Spirit. Later, William E. McClellan claimed that the Spirit poured out was mainly wine, and that Samuel became so intoxicated that he threw up several times. Other accounts suggest Samuel may have had a drinking problem also. Troubles for church leaders forced them to flee from Kirtland in January of 1838. Samuel and his family would travel to Missouri with Joseph and family, and while Joseph settled his family in Far West, Samuel and Mary moved north a few miles to Marrowbone Creek, where he farmed with the prospects of a good harvest for the season of 1838. His only son, Samuel Harrison Bailey Smith, was born there, reportedly on August the 1st, 1838. However, the events occurring at the time of his birth suggest the date closer to the October 1st. Mobs came, took Mary, her three-day-old baby, and her two young daughters, placed them on a feather tick, carried them outside in the rain, and burned their home. An 11-year-old boy began to drive her toward Far West, where Samuel had gone to borrow a wagon for the very purpose of removing his family from harm's way. Samuel met the boy and returned to Far West. Somehow the Smiths and other saints of the time bought into this the paradigm that sacrifice brings forth the blessings of heaven. Often that belief was about all they had to sustain themselves. Although Mary was very sick, Samuel left her with his mother and family and joined the Mormon militia to engage in the Missouri troops at the Battle of Crooked River, October the 25th, 1838. Joseph and Hiram were captured and incarcerated in Liberty Jail. Samuel and fellow militiamen managed to escape, were helped by friendly Indians, and then crossed the Mississippi River into Quincy, Illinois, sometime in late January or early February, 1839. The Smith families in Far West began their departure from Missouri after Don Carlos arrived Christmas Day, 1838. Together they made their way to the river, bringing Samuel's little family with them. Samuel had made arrangements to ferry them across the Mississippi to Quincy, where he had rented a small house. Shortly thereafter, Samuel made arrangements with George Miller to farm some of his land in McDonald County, free for fixing up the cabins. He spent the summer of 1839 farming. Daughter Mary wrote later that he cornered a buck deer on the farm and managed to kill it with only his pocket knife. Samuel moved into Nauvoo in late 1839, where he worked for Joseph. In September of 1840, Joseph Sr. called the family together to give each his parting blessing. Father Smith died immediately thereafter, September the 14th, 1840. Mary gave birth to their fourth child, Lucy, in January 1841, but by the 25th, both she and the baby were dead. Mary had never recovered from the trauma of Missouri. She was dead at age 32 after only 6 years of marriage. Her death left Samuel widowed with three small children under 6 years of age, who must have been taken in by mother Lucy and other family members. Samuel, during this period of time, was appointed an associate justice of the municipal court on January the 1st, 1841, and assigned to chair the Committee on Improvement. He was called as a counselor to Bishop Vincent Knight, January the 19th, 1841. When Knight died a year later, Samuel was appointed bishop of one of the Nauvoo wards, but refused the assignment. When John C. Bennett was elected mayor of Nauvoo in February of 1841, Samuel was selected as one of the aldermen. He was not re-elected in 1843, but he was chosen as a regent of the University of Nauvoo in February 1841. Samuel was called on another mission to Scott County, Illinois in April 1841, where he met and married Levira Clark in May. She lived with her family while Samuel completed his mission when both returned to Nauvoo in the fall. His brother Don Carlos had died August the 7th, 1841, age 25. His and Levira's first daughter, Levira, was born April the 29th, 1842. They would have two more daughters, with the youngest being born after Samuel's death. He had moved his family near Williams Public House in Plymouth. Samuel owned land and farmed there during the summer of 1843 and the spring of 1844. By this time, he seems to be out of the leadership loop in Nauvoo. Nevertheless, Joseph's plans for the church and kingdom would impact Samuel directly. Joseph, in keeping with his theocratic concept and that there was a law upon which all blessings are predicated, Joseph began to institute those laws. He introduced the doctrines and practices in a climate of secrecy that created conflict among both the saints and their neighbors. The Nauvoo Charter came close to Joseph's hope for a theocracy in which he would set up at least six secret or sacred orders. His ideas would all too soon bear their fatal fruit. In 1841, Joseph's internal security forces were set up in which Samuel was a guard. The Nauvoo Legion was formed for external security. Samuel held the rank of captain. The Masonic Order was introduced in 1842, and as far as I can tell, Samuel was not a Mason. While Joseph's polygamy dates back to the Kirtland period, it would become more general in 1841 Nauvoo, with the elect few introduced to it by 1843. Samuel did not embrace polygamy. He did, however, receive his temple endowment in 1842 and was initiated into the anointed comb December the 17th, 1843. Finally, Joseph set up his theocratic government called the Council of 50, which group then ordained him king, priest, and ruler over Israel in the last days. Samuel was not in this group. Joseph's very radical ideas and practices were bound to create problems for him and his movement. With the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor, opposition became focused and intense. Joseph and Hiram were arrested, taken to Carthage, and killed. When Samuel heard of their arrest, he immediately set out for Carthage, finally managing to get through on a fast horse, but too late to protect his brothers. However, before returning with the bodies, Samuel, Willard Richards and wounded John Taylor sent a letter to be published in the Times and Season, counseling the saints not to respond with violence and so forth. Samuel drove a wagon back to Nauvoo with one of the bodies while Willard Richard rode horseback. That day-long trip provided them an opportunity to ponder the questions. What do we do now, and who is to succeed to leadership? Samuel's claims were discussed in the Anointed Quorum, July the 10th, 1844. He could argue that he was the oldest surviving Smith male, and he was entitled to the office of the patriarch. And further, Joseph had said that were he and Hiram both taken, Samuel should succeed. William Clayton notes that the apostles Richard and Phelps were secretive about their doings at this time. Since Joseph's important secret orders were sacred, only a select few knew what was going on in Nauvoo. Willard Richards, apostle, cousin to Brigham Young, polygamist and secretary to the prophet, probably knew as much as anyone. He accompanied Joseph and Hiram across the Mississippi River and also to Carthage. Samuel took sick on July the 13th, which was 3 days after his claim had been made, and became violently ill, with Dr. Richards attending and Hosea Stout as nurse. He died July the 30th, 1844, aged 36 years, 4 months, and 17 days. Their care included giving Samuel a white powder. His mother, Lucy, reported that Samuel complained of pain, which she associated with the stresses of his brother's death. His obituary praised him as a good man and noted that bilious fever caused his demise. John Bernheisel, William Smith, and Mary Norman, that's his daughter, claimed that Samuel had been poisoned. Bernheisel said by his enemies, or the enemies of the church, and the Smiths by Richard and Stout. Richard may have seen Samuel's leadership as a threat to the practice of polygamy, which he and the apostles in general had embraced. Had Samuel been designated leader before the return of Brigham Young and the other quorum members, there may have been a serious challenge to their eventual dominance and leadership. At best, the case for poisoning, however, is circumstantial. The faithful seem satisfied that Samuel, too, had become a martyr, giving his life for the church. Ruby K. Smith, a granddaughter in her book Mary Bailey, and Dean Jarman in his 1960 MA thesis at BYU on Samuel, see him as having filled his mission and being taken home to rest, as his father promised in his parting blessing. So what did Samuel's good and faithful life mean for his descendants? His only son, Samuel Harrison H.B. Smith, would have children, none of the others. My grandfather's mother died before he was three. His father died before he was six. And in 1848, at age 10, my grandfather walked most of the way to Zion. He served two missions for the LDS Church with his cousin Joseph F. Smith to the Eastern States in England and Denmark. He married first in 1860 and polygamously in 1880, after which his first wife would divorce him, and had large families by both wives. He served 5 months for conscience sake in the territorial prison in 1887. He had married two Tuttle sisters, Rachel, who was my grandmother, and Clara, in 1886. My father, Heman Tuttle Smith, was born to Rachel in 1895. Grandma chose to move to the Bighorn Basin in Wyoming, where her three grown children by a first marriage joined the Mormon pioneers to settle that area in 1901. Dad, only six, saw his father once more when he left to serve a mission in 1913. His father died the next summer. Thus, neither Dad nor Grandpa really knew his own father, all a part of the legacy Samuel H. Smith embraced so fervently. Samuel H. has a large posterity now, all through his only son. Most, I understand, honor his legacy and embrace the faith that Samuel H. gave his life for. Had he lived until I was born, he would have been 120 years old. I became a great-grandfather at age 73, and I now have lived more than twice as long as he did. My grandfather would have been 90 when I was born, but he died before his 76th birthday in June of 1914. I am proud to be a Smith. I grew up in the church with a sense of noblesse oblige. My own spiritual path now diverges dramatically from my Smith forebears, but I marvel at both their commitment and their lives. They chose to live their own realities fully. I can honor that. Thank you.
Have the people who ask questions or give comments get them on the mic, and so I'm going to ask you, instead of the usual raising your hand, just raise your body up and walk down the aisle. So Will, and if there's somebody else, just go ahead and take the second or third spot in line if somebody's already here. So Will will go first.
I'll pass it. Mel, two questions. What was Joseph Sr. in jail for in about 1830? And second, what motivated Samuel Harrison Bailey Smith to walk to Utah in 1848? Wasn't he taken in by other Smith relatives?
Well, Joseph was in jail because he had a debt to pay. That was why he was in jail at that time. As far as Samuel Harrison Bailey walking to Utah, he was taken in by Max's daughter, Max's parent, their stepmother, Nevada, who had three children by Samuel. Two of them didn't live to maturity, but Nevada lived to maturity, and she would marry Joseph F. Smith, the first cousin. When Joseph F. went into polygamy, then she divorced him. But Samuel, their stepmother, just before she had a child that was born just in August of 1844. And so she left to, she just left the kid there. Said, you go down and pay for the living thing, but don't bring the water. And she just left. I think she just overwhelmed and couldn't handle it. And so the kids come back, they were excited about playing, and come back and sit on the step by the house. And maybe the Cummings family, maybe a few of them, Joseph or Hines widow, sent somebody over to them. And they said, no, my mother will be back. Mary Fielding was very sensitive and said, well, let him go to sleep and then we'll just bring him in. And then Samuel was the only one of the family of the children, Samuel's children, that went to Utah, and he was assigned to find to the Elias Smith, Judge Elias Smith family. And they went there, and he left his memoirs, and he talked about getting into Utah, and he had Pioneer Park and being assigned to Hunt's cars and stuff up in the avenues very, very quickly.
Okay, next.
This is for William. Do you know where the Hodge brothers were eventually buried there?
Unmarked.
Yes. Is there another cemetery or was it in?
Stay there if you have a question.
It was very interesting. We were having a regular Sabbath or Sunday meeting. About five apostles there, Pratt and Brigham Young, say, well, we've been hearing a lot of complaints, and there's thousands of people around listening to this, and we really should take these Hodge brothers out of our cemetery. I just found some new documents in the Leonard Arrington collection, and then William, right in front of everybody, gets up and argues, and he says, no, they're good men, and they should stay here. And it was put before the congregation a vote, should they stay or should we buy some unmarked land to rebury them in? And it was the whole congregation except three people said, let's remove and rebury them. So it's unknown really where they went.
If you have a follow-up, I didn't mean to cut you off. Okay.
Are you related to the Hodges?
Well, this is an issue that we've
This is an issue that I've been exploring for 30-some-odd years because my great-great-grandfather was Abraham Hodge, and I've talked to Bill last year at the Mormon History Conference because that's how I got involved in doing church history, is trying to research, because Abraham Hodge was a lifeguard of Joseph Smith, and I was trying to get the connection to this gang in Nauvoo.
Identify your name.
It's, my name is Lynn Hodge.
Next question, and in more than one can come down the aisle at one time, but we sure would like to get
Very nice papers. Just a brief comment on Levinas, on Calvin Stoddard. Basically, the main man who helped build the Frame Smith home in Manchester was Russell Stoddard. And this is recorded in some documents, court documents, relating to a suit of Russell Stoddard versus Joseph Smith, meaning the father, where it says was the effect that Joseph Smith Sr. Owes money to Stoddard, Russell Stoddard, for building the house and also for providing, you know, paying for the nails. It's also mentioned in the George Albert Smith, George Albert Smith Journal at 1907, some interviews he made.
Any comments? What? This man was there. Okay, Michael Marquardt just spoke. Yeah, let's give your name.
Reed Harper, and my question is, do we know where Samuel Smith was buried, and is there any, if so, is there any appetite for doing forensic studies on the body to run down the poisoning question?
Samuel Smith is buried in the Smith Family Cemetery with supposedly the area where Joseph and him. So I have buried my great-great-grandfather and grandmother are buried in the Smith Family Cemetery, Joseph C.D. and Lucy Merrick, and my grandfather and great-grandfather and great-grandmother are also buried there, as well as the daughter Lucy who died there. They're listed on the family plaque. Now, as far as forensics, you might prove that there's some poisoning if you could find which bones are his. I would think that would be pretty hard by now. But it still wouldn't implicate Ward Richard or Hosea Stout.
It's interesting that in 1848, in J.J. Strang's Gospel Herald, in an article called Martyrs of the Latter-day Saints, and they list all the ones, and they list at the end, and Samuel Harrison Smith, who was poisoned at Nauvoo.
Next question, and come on down the aisle and give your name. Go ahead, yes, Hodge.
I'll make another comment. I believe that the Hodge brother that was knifed to death outside of Brigham Young's house, that you mentioned that it was Hosea Stout or his brother that actually was the one that performed the duty. Can you elaborate on that?
Michael Quinn says in Origins that I am convinced that Hosea Stout either moved Irving Hodge or concealed the identity of his brother Alan Stout, and I fully concur with that. William Hall, in his book, The Abominations of Mormonism, exposed, which is a bad book, but he does say in this specifically that they staked out people around Brigham Young's house, and that Hosea Stout made the attack. Now, the attack was so severe, a bowie knife went clear through the body, severing three backbones, and he was struck with clubs, as Quinn would say, police clubs. So he was savagely, terribly murdered right in front of the house. And I personally have no doubt that it was Hosea Stout.
Well, and it didn't kill him instantly. He was...
Well, the accounts, we have the account, really, of of Alan Stout, who was one of the two policemen. John Scott was the other one. And they said that he lived for a while, and there's some indication that he may have had some faculties for a while. One report says he refused to tell who attacked him, but that doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be too true, really.
Next question. Yes.
Perhaps a question. My name is Hugo Lyons. Perhaps a question more in context of what's going on with the church. To what extent is Smith Family Cemetery in Nauvoo has helped to bring the Utah and the Church of Christ part of the families, Smith families, together? I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that.
Malcolm would probably be the best equipped to.
I can't see that they have been brought together very much. The Long and History Association and the John Whitmore Historical Association, it seems to me, has been the arena in which that the bombing has taken place, and there's been a lot of bombing that has gone on there. Now, in 1972, they had the Joseph Smith Senior Family Reunion in Nauvoo. And Buddy Edgett in England was the promoter of that movement at that time. And my father and mother were still living, so my wife and I took them back to Nauvoo for that reunion. So it was a chance for my father, who lives all by himself in Northern Ireland, and knew his two half-brothers by his mother's sister, Clara. Two tiny boys are about his age, so he knew them and integrated with them a little bit. But he didn't know any of the other Smith family members, so it was really quite an emotional experience for Dad to get back and see them, and glad that he could do that.
Next. Ready? Michael Marquardt again.
Just want to comment on that. Murder of Irvine Hodge was a comment to Bill last year that John Whitmer. Basically, I think there's just probably some of the mob, the gangsters that Irvine was with, who probably came across the river. Because Irvine came across the Mississippi River and stopped at the home of William Smith, who was living in the old William Marks home, and then went up to Brigham's home. But I've checked the journal of Willard Richards, George A. Smith, and there's really no indication that the police did it. But so I lean toward it was probably one of his fellow gang members.
Okay, others?
This is a question for Bill. Oh, Kent Olson. And obviously, William Smith was quite a colorful character. I know you've frequently referred to him as Crazy Uncle William. Just how does the Community of Christ Church regard him?
That's Crazy Uncle William. I don't think we pay a lot of attention to him. Certainly Joseph III, when William came into the church and wanted, you know, big glories and stuff like that. Paul and Ron might correct me on some of this, but I think Joseph tried to pacify him. He came in as... Well,
you might
know.
No, get Paul to comment on
that.
There's an article about
Paul is the one. Here's the authoritative source. In fact, I always refer to him as Crazy Uncle William because he's Paul's uncle.
I think William was the sanest one of the bunch. Far as I know, Joseph III tried very hard to bring him back into the fold, but William constantly put up barricades that made that impossible. And I think even though he finally died as a member of the church in quote good standing, he left behind, as you know, volumes of letters begging for money, begging for position. And I don't
I don't know what his intentions were, but he certainly left as a member, but without any ecclesiastical authority.
We have time for like one more question, because we just have 2 or 3 minutes. Anybody want to ask the final question? Of course, it's also no sin to eat 2 or 3 minutes early either. So, one more comment. Yeah.
I've been amazed at how my own life was enlaced with some of these things. When I came home from my mission in 1950, I went to tried to get out through the pageant in Palmyra, and my cousin, by my grandmother's first marriage, and her husband,